got one other person signed up, and this is Bill Gary of the Department of Justice. Commissioner Roberts, were you going to testify on this?
No.
Okay. All right, good. Then I'll just... was anyone else going to that you know of, or just you?
I don't want it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Patty Greenfield, and I am here on behalf of Senate President John Kitzhaber, who supports Senate Bill 1020. A version of this bill, which had bipartisan support, was vetoed last session. Current law does not clearly set out the relationship between either the Legislative Assembly and the Attorney General, or the Judiciary Branch and the Attorney General in matters of legal representation. There are times when the AG and those he is to represent find themselves responding to different priorities which come into conflict. The result is a lack of clarity in conducting the state's business when the interests of client, agencies of state government, and the attorney, the AG, are in conflict. For this reason, I support the provisions that provide Legislative Assembly use of legislative counsel or any member of the state, Oregon State Bar for legal representation. Legislative counsel be attorney of record in cases where the Legislative Assembly or a member is named as a party. The Attorney General shall appear on behalf of the Legislative Assembly when specifically requested. And I support those provisions that limit the authority of the AG to assign counsel except with regard to the executive and administrative branches. Limit the authority of the Attorney General to control and supervise legal proceedings involving the Legislative Assembly. In addition, I would support any amendment that would extend those provisions to statewide elected officials. When for perfectly good reason the priorities of the AG and an elected or appointed official come into conflict, it makes good fiscal, administrative, legal, and programmatic sense to allow those who will be held accountable to have the full range of responsibility and authority, including decisions having to do with legal representation, to manage in their areas of responsibility.
Okay, any questions? All right, thank you. Let's see. Commissioner Roberts, you want to come on up?
Chairman Frey, members of the committee, I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1020 and specifically address the amendments which are consistent with the spirit and philosophy and the reasoning behind Senate Bill 1020. Specifically, I want to mention to you that the main issue, I think, is delineating the authority, as in Senate Bill 1020 for the legislature, for elected officials, independently elected and given separate statutory authority, to enforce and reasonably interpret the statutes over which the Bureau, in my case, the Bureau has been given jurisdiction, and to delineate between that and the Attorney General's authority to manage the legal affairs of the state. The difficulties that we experience are a product of an institutional relationship that puts the authority in matters of policy, administration, enforcement, and accountability to the public with me, and control of the legal proceedings with the Attorney General. As was stated earlier, if the relationship were simply one of client to attorney, no issues of control or authority would arise. Because of our particular system, those kinds of problems have, in fact, arisen. Basically, we feel that the choices should be made by the client, and private counsel is ethically bound to carry out such decisions made in good faith. The authority and the obligation of the Attorney General and other elected state officers are created by statute and therefore by members of the legislature. And so it is up to you to make the choice as to who is to be held accountable in fact and who is to interpret the statutes which you have assigned to us. I believe that you have clearly expressed your intent in statute. In my own case, you spoke very loudly and clearly in the Civil Rights Statute, for example. In ORS 659.103, the commissioner is empowered by rule to define what constitutes a violation of civil rights in employment, housing, public accommodation, and other areas. The discretion and interpretive authority granted is very broad. The commissioner may, and I quote, establish rules covering any other matter required to carry out the purpose, end quote, of these statutes. The Attorney General has asserted his authority to resolve what he considers differences of legal interpretation between the Bureau and those state agencies accused of violating the civil rights laws and against whom we are proceeding with cases. Further, that it's the Attorney General's role to resolve such issues without judicial intervention, even where the Bureau's interpretation is consistent with past practices and policy and legally adopted administrative rules interpreting the statute under my jurisdiction, and where, in fact, there is an administrative hearing process with court review, which will ensure that the laws are, in fact, interpreted correctly. We have had instances where the Attorney General is representing one side, the defense, the state agency, in a contested case hearing. And because of the statutes which allow me to get independent counsel with the Attorney General's permission, we are represented otherwise in those hearings. But that really does not resolve the conflict when the Attorney General interjects an Attorney General's opinion into that process as an objective resolution of the problem, and potentially making a, shall we say, disturbing the orderly administrative review and the court review of the matters that have been presented at hearing. You have copies of my testimony. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip through it here and paraphrase. Basically, I want to get to the key areas of the amendments. Section 7, subsection 2A, would allow statewide elected officials to hire outside counsel when the Attorney General would otherwise advise and represent both sides to a dispute. Conflict, in my mind, lies not simply in representing in administrative proceedings both sides. The conflict also lies in giving advice to both sides during the entire process in which that particular case where the conflict is inherent is in the system. Currently, the Bureau is forced to employ the Department of Justice if it desires legal counsel in the development and presentation of civil rights actions against state agencies on behalf of individual employees, and these agencies, of course, are defended by the Attorney General, who is also our attorney. And under current law, the Attorney General alone may determine when a conflict and interest exists. These amendments would place that decision with the client, not the attorney, and leave it to those charged with enforcing and interpreting the law to decide when it's appropriate to seek independent counsel. Section 8, subsection 2, the bill codifies the authority of statewide elected officials to independently interpret the statutes over which they've been given powers of administration or enforcement, and to make it clear the direction to the Attorney General that the Department of Justice is to defend such interpretations when called upon to do so. As amended, the bill would clarify the power of elected officials to exercise the authority given in their statutes and to assure that that authority is commensurate with their responsibilities. Subsection 3B of Section 15 would eliminate the Attorney General's advance determination prior to accepting the defense of a statewide elected official, whether that official has acted in disregard of his or her duties. As you can well might imagine, the possibility of personal liability or expense can have a chilling effect on the exercise of independent judgment. There's a thinly veiled threat, whether intended or not, that failure to abide by the Attorney General's opinion or legal conclusion on policy matters, where there's a real difference of opinion as to what is policy and what is legal interpretation, exposes the elected official to a public fight at personal expense. A state official acting in good faith and in accordance with his or her duties should not be placed in a position of weighing his or her duty to enforce the law against protecting your own pocketbook. That's an unacceptable threat to independent judgment and imposes on the official an intolerable conflict of interest. I would hasten to point out that these amendments would not absolve officials of liability for attorney's fees or judgments if they are determined, in fact, by the courts to have acted in willful disregard of their duties. But this determination would and should be made after the official's day in court and by the judicial branch of government. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on the amendments, and I understand that you've received letters from at least two other state elected officials in support of the conflict of interest portion, at least of the, specifically. And my understanding is that, am I correct that you've already received those letters?
Well, we have one from Superintendent Duncan.
You should have one also from Barbara Roberts, Secretary of State.
No.
We have one from the Chief Justice.
Apparently the one from the Secretary of State is just now being handed out.
Treasurer Bill Rutherford is in Los Angeles.
All right, well,
glad to answer any questions you might have.
Next time you come with amendments, I wish you'd bring us enough copies so I could have them in my hands of my committee members so we could follow your testimony.
The Legislative Council should have provided those amendments. Didn't they?
We don't have any.
We have copies. You have copies.
You brought one copy.
One copy?
So the committee members didn't have a chance
amendments?
To. Pardon the amendments. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen them.
No. Do you have any questions of Commissioner Roberts? Anything from staff?
No, sir.
Yes. In terms of the fiscal impact of your use of legal services, who has the final say, the final control over your legal services budget? Is it you or the AG?
Well, we've had a lot of discussions of that. What it boils down to is that we obviously have the authority within our agency to allocate our resources. What we get into on the fiscal side of it is whether or not we feel we're getting the bang for the buck, whether or not our billings are proper, and we've had a number of meetings on that basis. But the fiscal responsibility does lie with the agency.
Do you have control over how much of your budget the AG spends on any particular matter?
Again, we try to exercise that control. There are times when we are told that it's going to take more time and it's going to be more money involved, and many times that's absolutely the case, and that we can agree on that. The concerns in that area can be addressed through, I think, a lot of negotiation and question of what we send over there to do at one time. We do have discussions on priorities.
Does the AG ever ask you to evaluate the services that he provides through his staff? You ever had an opportunity in any formal sense to tell him what quality of services he's giving you?
I think that we've both given each other feedback on how our various staffs interact, and we have raised some issues, and they have raised some issues. We had some regarding whether or not cases sent over to the Department of Justice for preparation for hearing could be more case ready so that they're to minimize the work that they did, and we've absorbed back into our agency a lot of things to do that otherwise they would do, and it's resulted in lowered cost. And this is particularly true in the hearings area, where by our staff doing things that their staff had been doing before, we're able to get things expedited and move things along, and the cost is quite a bit lower.
If I might interject, I think also the Attorney General has...
State your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Kelly Hagan, Legal Policy Advisor for the Bureau of Labor. I believe also the Attorney General does make a formal inquiry of all of the client agencies and asks for a written formal response on the quality of the services received.
I think that the concern here is that I think that the Department of Justice has a clear point of view, and I expect that they will speak to that. They have spoken to us on that point. We simply disagree. I can quote from a communication from the Department of Justice, which was a Attorney General's opinion that was issued after a case of ours against the state had gone to a contested case hearing, but prior to the issuance of an order. And I quote, "Several complaints to the Bureau have alleged employment discrimination under this act by other state agencies. In addition, several civil suits are pending in the circuit courts alleging violations of the act by various state agencies. The Attorney General represents the state of Oregon and not any particular agency. It's important, especially important when more than one agency has a stake in a legal issue, that the Department of Justice clearly articulate one and only one legal position for the state." So if we are essentially in a process of going against another state agency, pursuing the statute specifically assigned to us to enforce, you know, my understanding is the Attorney General feels that regardless of that, they can say, well, Corrections or Department of Transportation or whatever agency has a stake and you have a stake, we'll make the interpretation of the law. And that creates a problem, obviously, because in the law, clearly, I have the responsibility to enforce the statutes, and I cannot abdicate that authority, even when it might be perhaps personally more comfortable not to think of a disagreement that might put my house on the line or something like that if I disagree. We get some 1,500 complaints a year, you can imagine. I would hope that they wouldn't all end up in that kind of a disagreement. But when we are going against a state agency where we have found discrimination, a substantial evidence of discrimination, and in particular when the Assistant Attorney General assigned to our agency concurs that that's a court-worthy case, and we proceed, and then we run into, shall we say, a difference in legal interpretation, it creates a major problem, and I think there is a conflict of interest. And I think it needs to be resolved. I would like to have seen a clear line to the court, which actually makes determination of what the law is. That's the whole concept of our system of checks and balances and separation of powers. But if you can't get it into the court system because of this kind of intervention or disagreement as to what's legal, a point of law and policy, the courts don't get to make that determination, and I think that's wrong. And I think that's why when there's a conflict that's a legitimate conflict, that it deserves that attention and that independent advice and potential court review. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Yes, Senator Hill.
Are you saying that you've had situations where there have just been disagreements within the Attorney General's office over a civil rights case?
Yes.
And I assume that's because an Assistant Attorney General is representing the agency that's been accused of discrimination?
Yes.
And
one is advising, has been advising us up until the time that we obtain independent counsel for the actual contested case hearing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Bill Geary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Deputy Attorney General Bill Geary. With me is Jim Mountain, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Department of Justice and in opposition to Senate Bill 1020. As a matter of process, I should point out that we obtained yesterday afternoon copies of the amendments that Commissioner Roberts has referred to. They were not provided to us prior to that time by either legislative counsel or the commissioner. I'm prepared to address them generally, but I propose, unless the committee has a contrary preference, first to speak to the bill itself, and then I will address the somewhat broader provisions of the amendments. We oppose Senate Bill 1020, not because of what it says with respect to our relationship with the Legislative Assembly. We think it merely clarifies existing law with respect to our relationship with individual members of the legislature and the legislature itself. We don't believe that the provisions relating to the Legislative Assembly make any changes in our relationship, add any greater power to the Legislative Council Committee or to the legislature itself, nor do we think that it dilutes the representation that the Attorney General traditionally has provided to the legislature. It is true in most instances that the Attorney General's job is to defend the policy judgments of this body, and we take that role very seriously. There are instances where there are intra-branch disputes, such as a dispute over the extent of the governor's veto authority, where the Attorney General may, and appropriately so, represent the branch of government to which he belongs, the executive branch, and it's perfectly appropriate in those circumstances for the legislature to seek and obtain its own counsel, and it always has had the power to do so. Our problem with Senate Bill 1020 relates to a more subtle shift in the balance of power with respect to the relationship between this body and the executive branch and the judicial department. The provisions of 1020 would amend ORS Chapter 180, the Department of Justice Act, to provide that the Attorney General is the chief legal officer for the executive and administrative branch. It would explicitly exempt from the Attorney General's representation, except when they choose to avail themselves of it, the judicial department. It would authorize the judicial department to retain its own attorneys to represent it in court. We think that's a fairly serious shift in the balance of power away from the legislative and executive branches and to the judicial department. We are aware that Chief Justice Peterson has written to the committee indicating his view that the separation of powers compels the result that would be affected by enactment of Senate Bill 1020 in its present form. We respectfully disagree with the Chief Justice. We've had extensive discussions with him and with Mr. Linden, and we disagree as a matter of theory. Our view, a view that I think is consistent with the view of the federal government, is that the representation of the state as state in litigation is an executive function, and it would, in fact, violate the separation of powers for the judicial department to perform that function. There is an express rule of court that prohibits any federal judicial employee from appearing in any capacity as a litigant or a representative of a litigant in litigation. There's a good reason for that. Judges are about judging. Their job is to make the decisions in cases that come before them. It is not their role. It is not their piece of the several parts of constituent government power that have been divided up among the branches of government to advocate. They decide the cases that come before them. If you give the judicial department the added responsibility to pick and choose when it will, what cases it will bring before itself to decide, you have given the judicial department substantial new power that it does not have now. I think
the bill doesn't do that, though, does it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think it does. It authorizes the judicial department to retain its own counsel anytime it chooses, independent of the Attorney General, to initiate litigation. And let me say, not just with respect to those areas where we are in complete agreement, it is appropriate for the judicial department to be independently represented, those issues that involve the balance of power between the branches of government. We would not purport to represent the judicial department in a dispute with the executive branch over the shift of balance of powers.
You said that the bill would, the way I heard you, you said the bill would give the Supreme Court the power to decide what cases it heard. If you said that, you surely don't mean that, do you?
No, Senator Frye. Obviously, they have the power to decide what cases they will hear now as adjudicators. My point is that when you give them the power to initiate litigation, when you give the judicial department the power to initiate litigation and litigate cases in addition to deciding them, you have allowed them to, in effect, sit on both sides of the bench.
All right. What kind of a case, hypothetically, could you suggest that the Supreme Court or the judicial department might, the judiciary might bring? What kind of litigation would I'm having a hard time figuring out what the Supreme Court, what kind of lawsuit the Supreme Court might bring, for example.
Well, actually, whether it would ever get to litigation is a question about the extent to which the various branches of government choose to flex their muscle. Let me give you two examples, one where we think it is an appropriate instance for the Judicial Department to be independently represented and one where we think it is not. We are in agreement with the Chief Justice that in those areas representing the core functions of the judicial branch, that is the business of judging, the separation of powers protects them from interference by the legislative or the executive branch. Therefore, if there were a statute passed that purported to regulate the manner in which the Supreme Court would exercise its collegial decision-making, an argument could be made that violated the principles of separation of powers. To the extent that the court chose to make that argument, it would be appropriate for them to be represented independent of the Attorney General if they so chose, and the Attorney General or the Attorney General declined to represent them. That's a case much like the veto power issue that I mentioned earlier, where the legislature and the executive might find themselves at cross purposes. The kinds of cases where the Judicial Department might well disagree with the executive branch on the interpretation of the statute and choose to litigate or otherwise to disregard the counsel of the Attorney General's office and seek their own counsel are in the same areas that would affect any other agency. Public contracting law. There has been some hearty discussion between our office and the Court Administrator's office, which is in effect an administrative agency, over the extent to which the Judicial Department is subject to the same provisions of the public contracting law that apply to any other agency. Collective bargaining law, that matter was actually litigated in a case called Lent versus Erb, where the contention of the then Chief Justice was that the Constitution would be violated by a provision subjecting the Judicial Department to the public employees' collective bargaining law. The case was decided by the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court adversely to the position of the Chief Justice, but they chose to litigate the issue. So there are instances where it can come up. Other areas where it might become significant are covered in the statutes now. Representation of judges in mandamus cases are covered in specific statutes, and generally we will represent the judge except in those instances where the state is a party to the underlying litigation. And if we decline to represent the judge for any reason, the statutes authorize the court administrator to appoint an attorney to represent the judge in a mandamus or other writ proceeding. Our opposition to the provisions of Senate Bill 1020 will not be any surprise to the members of the committee. We have opposed all proposals for the creation of independent counsel. It is a tradition in this state dating back to at least 1916, as you've heard in other contexts, for legal services to be consolidated. With respect to the proposed amendments put forth by the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, our opposition is only that much greater because the mischief that those amendments would do to the concept of integrated legal services is significantly greater. We believe that the amendments are wrongheaded for at least three reasons. First of all, they would be budgetary folly. Secondly, we think they're bad government theory. And thirdly, we think they're bad public policy. Let me address the budget issue first because it's an issue that is near and dear to my heart, having just completed our budget hearings in the Ways and Means Subcommittee. The Department of Justice provides legal services for all state agencies in government, including litigation services, for what amounts to less than 0.25% of the entire state operating budget. There are very few major corporations whose legal services budgets are so small. Enactment of the amendments proposed by the Commissioner would most certainly increase the cost of legal services in this state for two reasons. First of all, the Department of Justice, operating under a billing system, currently charges $50 an hour for its services. Private counsel, who would be retained by independently elected officials in their sole discretion under the proposed amendments charge on the average in this state, according to the State Bar Committee on the Economics of the Law Practice, $80 per hour. That includes the lowest, most recent graduates and the senior partners in Portland law firms, and that's an average sum. We do it cheaper, and we do it more efficiently because of integrated legal services. Secondly, the bill would permit, and I think, in fact, a major purpose underlying the bill is to permit lawsuits where both sides of the case are represented by state-paid attorneys. That is what we characterize as lawsuits involving state versus state. We think that's bad policy, but whether it's bad policy or not, it certainly is more expensive because the taxpayers are asked to foot the bill for litigation, paying both attorneys to argue their case before the court. We think the amendments are bad government theory because if you look at the first page of the amendments, the first section includes legislative findings. Insofar as we're aware, those findings would represent the first time that this legislature has recognized the right, and I underscore that term, the right of elected officials to do anything. Traditionally, the election of someone to an office is viewed as a public trust, and it carries with it certain duties and responsibilities.